Don't shoot them, Prax said. What if it's May? What if they have her with them?
They don't, Doc, Amos said. Stay down.
Holden was shouting, words rolling out of him too fast to follow. Prax didn't know if he was talking to Amos or Wendell or Naomi back on the ship, or him. It could have been any of them. All of them. Four men came around the corner, weapons in hand. They wore the same coveralls that all the others had worn. One had long black hair and a goatee. Another was a woman with skin the color of buttercream. The two in the middle could have been brothers. The same close-cut brown hair, the same long noses. From somewhere to Prax's right, the shotgun spoke twice. All four fell back. It was like something out of a prank comedy. Eight legs swept at once. Four people Prax didn't know, had never met, just fell down. They just fell down. He knew they were never getting back up.
Wendell, Holden said, report?
Caudle's dead, Wendell said.
He didn't sound sad about it. He didn't sound like anything.
I think I broke my wrist. Anyone know where they came from?
Nope, Holden said. Let's not assume they were alone, though.
They retraced their steps, back through the long, wide passages, past bodies of men and women they hadn't killed, but who were dead now anyway. Prax didn't try to keep from weeping. There was no point. If he could keep his legs moving, one foot in front of the other, it was enough. They reached the bloodied pit after a few minutes, or an hour, or a week. Prax couldn't tell, and all options seemed equally plausible. The ruptured bodies stank, the spilled blood thickening to a black currant jelly, the open viscera freeing colonies of bacteria usually held in check by the gut. On the catwalk, a woman stood. What was her name? Paula, that was it.
Why aren't you at your post?
Wendell snapped when he saw her.
Guthrie called for backup. Said he was gut-shot and about to pass out. I brought him some adrenaline and speed.
Good call, Wendell said.
Uchi and Caudle?
Didn't make it, Wendell said.
The woman nodded, but Prax saw something pass over her. Everyone here was losing someone. His tragedy was just one among dozens, hundreds, thousands. By the time the cascade had run all the way out, maybe millions. When death grew that large, it stopped meaning anything. He leaned against the nitrogen bath, his head in his hands. He'd been so close. So close.
We have to find that ship, he said.
We have to drop back 10 and punt, Holden said. We came here looking for a missing kid. Now we've got a covert scientific station halfway to being packed up and shipped out. And a secret landing pad, and whatever third player was fighting with these people while we were.
Third player? Paula asked. Wendell gestured to the carnage.
Not us, he said.
We don't know what we're looking at, Holden said, and until we do, we need to back off.
We can't stop, Prax said. I can't stop. May is...
Probably dead, Wendell said. The girl's probably dead. And if she's not, she's alive someplace besides Ganymede.
I'm sorry, Holden said.
The dead boy, Prax said, Katoa. His father took the family off Ganymede as soon as he could. Got them someplace safe, someplace else.
Wise move, Holden said.
Prax looked to Amos for support, but the big man was poking through the wreckage, pointedly not taking either side. The boy was alive, Prax said. Basha said he knew the boy was dead, and he packed up and he left. And when he got on that transport, his boy was here, in this lab, and he was alive. So don't tell me May's probably dead. They were all silent for a moment.
Just don't, Prax said.
Cap, Amos said.
Just a minute, Holden said.
Prax... I'm not going to say that I know what you're going through, but I have people I love too. I can't tell you what to do, but let me ask you to look at what kind of strategy is going to be best for you and for May.
Cap, Amos said. Seriously, you should look at this.
Amos stood by the shattered glass cube. His shotgun hung forgotten in his hand. Holden walked up to the man's side, following his gaze to the ruined container. Prax pushed away from the nitrogen bath and joined them. There, clinging to the walls of glass that still stood, was a network of fine, black filament. Prax couldn't tell if it was an artificial polymer or a natural substance. Some kind of web. It had a fascinating structure, though. He reached out to touch it, and Holden grabbed his wrist, pulling him back so hard it hurt. When Holden spoke, his words were measured and calm, which only made the panic behind them more terrifying.
Naomi, prep the ship. We have to get off this moon. We have to do it right now.
Chapter 18. Avasarala.
What do you think? The Secretary General asked from the upper left pane of the display. On the upper right, Aaron Wright leaned forward a centimeter, ready to jump in if she lost her temper.
You've read the briefing, sir, Avasarala said sweetly.
The Secretary General waved his hand in a lazy circle. He was in his early 60s and wore the decades with the elfin charm of a man untroubled by weighty thoughts. The years Avasarala had spent building herself from the treasurer of the Workers' Provident Fund to the district governor of the Maharashtra-Karnataka-Goa Communal Interest Zone, he'd spent as a political prisoner at a minimum security facility in the recently reconstructed Andean cloud forest. The slow, grinding wheels of power had lifted him to celebrity, and his ability to appear to be listening lent him an air of gravity, without the inconvenience of an opinion of his own. Had a man been engineered from birth to be the ideal governmental figurehead, he still wouldn't have achieved the perfection that was Secretary General Esteban Sorrento Gillis.
Political briefs never capture the really important things, the bobblehead said. Tell me what you think.
I think you haven't read the fucking briefs, Avasarala thought. Not that I can really complain.
She cleared her throat.
It's all sparring and no fight, sir, Avasarala said. The players are top level. Michel Andor, Carson Santiseverin, Koshu. They brought enough military to show that it's not just the elected monkeys. But so far, the only one who said anything interesting is a marine they brought in to be a flower arrangement. Otherwise, we're all waiting for someone else to say something telling.
And what about,
the Secretary General paused and lowered his voice,
the alternative hypothesis?
There's activity on Venus, Avasarala said. We still don't know what any of it means. There was a massive upwelling of elemental iron in the northern hemisphere that lasted 14 hours. There has also been a series of volcanic eruptions. Since the planet doesn't have any tectonic motion, we're assuming the protomolecule is doing something in the mantle. But we can't tell what. The brains put together a statistical model that shows the approximate energy output expected for the changes we've seen. It suggests that the overall level of activity is rising about 300% per year over the last 18 months.
The Secretary General nodded, his expression grave. It was almost as if he'd understood any part of what she'd said.
Aaron Wright coughed.
Do we have any evidence that ties the activity on Venus to the events on Ganymede? He asked.
We do, Avasarala said. An anomalous energy spike at the same time as the Ganymede attack. But it's only one data point. It might have been a coincidence.
A woman's voice came from the Secretary General's feed, and he nodded.
I'm afraid I'm called to duty, he said. You're doing fine work, Avasarala. Damn fine work.
I can't tell you what that means coming from you, sir, she said with a smile. You'd fire me.
Half a beat later, the Secretary General barked out a laugh and wagged his finger at the screen before the green connection ended message took his place. Ehrenreich sat back, his palms pressed to his temples. Avasarala picked up her cup of tea and sipped it with her eyebrows lifted and her gaze on the camera, inviting him to say something. The tea wasn't quite down to tepid.
All right, Ehrenreich said. You win.
We're impeaching him? He actually chuckled. Wherever he was, it was dark outside his windows, so he was on the same side of the planet that she was. That they were both in night gave the meeting a sense of closeness and intimacy that had more to do with her own exhaustion than anything else.
What do you need to resolve the Venus situation? He asked.
Resolve?
Poor choice of words, he said. From the beginning of this, you've had your eye on Venus, keeping things calm with the Martians, reining in Nguyen.
Notice that, did you?
These talks are stalled, and I'm not going to waste you on babysitting a deadlock. We need clarity, and we need it a month ago. Ask for the resources you need, Kris Jenn, and either rule Venus out or get us proof. I'm giving you a blank check.
Retirement at last, she said, laughing.
To her surprise, Ehrenreich took it seriously.
If you want, but Venus first. This is the most important question either of us has ever asked. I'm trusting you.
I'll see to it, she said.
Ehrenreich nodded and dropped the connection. She leaned forward on her desk, fingertips pressed to her lips. Something had happened. Something had changed. Either Ehrenreich had read enough about Venus to get his own set of the heebie-jeebies, or someone wanted her off the Martian negotiation. Someone with enough pull to get Ehrenreich to kick her upstairs. Did Nguyen have patrons that powerful? Yes. It gave her what she wanted. After all she'd said and meant when she'd said it, she couldn't refuse the project. But the success had a bitter aftertaste. Perhaps she was reading too much into it. God knew she hadn't been getting enough sleep, and fatigue left her paranoid. She checked the time. 10:00 p.m. She wouldn't make it back to Arjun that night. Another morning in the depressing VIP quarters, drinking the weak coffee and pretending to care what the latest ambassador from the Pashwiri Autonomous Zone thought about dance music. Screw it, she thought. I need a drink. The Dasahari Lounge catered to the full range in the complex organism that was the United Nations. At the bar, young pages and clerks leaned into the light, laughing too loud and pretending to be more important than they were. It was a mating dance, only slightly more dignified than presenting like a mandrill, but endearing in its own fashion. Roberta Draper, the Martian Marine who'd shat on the table that morning, was among them, a pint glass dwarfed by her hand and an amused expression on her face. Soren would probably be there, if not that night, another time. Avasarala's son would probably have been among them if things had gone differently. In the center of the room, there were tables with built-in terminals to pipe in encrypted information from 1,000 different sources. Privacy baffles kept even the waitstaff from glimpsing over the shoulders of the middle-range administrators drinking their dinners while they worked. And in the back were dark wooden tables in booths that recognized her before she sat down. If anyone below a certain status walked too close, a discreet young man with perfect hair would sweep up and see them to a different table, elsewhere, with less important people. Avasarala sipped her gin and tonic, while the threads of implication wove and rewove themselves. Nguyen couldn't have enough influence to put Ehrenreich against her. Could the Martians have asked that she be removed? She tried to remember who she'd been rude to, and how,
but no good suspect came to mind. And if they had, what was she going to do about it? Well, if she couldn't be party to the Martian negotiations in an official capacity, she could still have contacts on an informal basis. Avasarala started chuckling even before she knew quite why. She picked up her glass, tapped the table to let it know it was permitted to let someone else sit there, and made her way across the bar. The music was soft arpeggios in a hyper-modern tonal scale, which managed to sound soothing despite itself. The air smelled of perfume too expensive to be applied tastelessly. As she neared the bar, she saw conversations pause, glances pass between one young fount of ambition and another. "The old lady," she imagined them saying. "What's she doing here?" She sat down next to Draper. The big woman looked over at her. There was a light of recognition in her eyes that boded well. She might not know who Avasarala was, but she'd guessed what she was. Smart, then. Perceptive. And fucking hell, the woman was enormous. Not fat, either, just big. "Buy you a drink, Sergeant?" Avasarala asked. "I've had a few too many already," she said. And a moment later, "All right." Avasarala lifted an eyebrow, and the bartender quietly gave the Marine another glass of whatever she'd been having before. "You made quite an impression today," Avasarala said. "I did," Draper said. She seemed serenely unconcerned about it. "Thorson's going to ship me out. I'm done here. May just be done." "That's fair. You've accomplished what they wanted from you anyway." Draper looked down at her. Polynesian blood, Avasarala guessed. Maybe Samoan. Some place that evolution had made humans like mountain ranges. Her eyes were narrowed, and there was a heat to them, an anger. "I haven't done shit." "You were here. That's all they needed from you." "What's the point?" "They want to convince me that the monster wasn't theirs. One argument they've made is that their own soldiers, meaning you, didn't know about it. By bringing you, they're showing that they aren't afraid to bring you. That's all they need. You could sit around with your thumb up your ass and argue about the offside rule all day. It would be just as good for them. You're a showpiece." The Marine took it in, then raised an eyebrow. "I don't think I like that," she said. "Yes, well," Avasarala said, "Thorson's a cunt. But if you stop working with politicians just for that, you won't have any friends." The Marine chuckled. Then she laughed. Then, seeing Avasarala's gaze on her own, she sobered. "That thing that killed your friends?" Avasarala said while the Marine was looking her in the eye. "It wasn't one of mine." Draper's inhalation was sharp. It was like Avasarala had touched a wound. Which made sense, because she had. Draper's jaw worked for a second. "It wasn't one of ours, either." "Well, at least we've got that settled." "It won't do any good, though. They won't do anything, they won't talk about anything. They don't care. You know that? They don't care what happens, as long as they all protect their careers and make sure the balance of power isn't tilted the wrong way. None of them fucking care what that thing was or where it came from." The bar around them wasn't silent, but it was quieter. The mating dance was now only the second most interesting thing happening at the bar. "I care," Avasarala said. "As a matter of fact, I've just been given a very great deal of latitude in finding out what that thing was." It wasn't entirely true. She'd been given a huge budget to implicate or rule out Venus, but it was close, and it was the right frame for what she wanted. "Really?" Draper said. "So what are you going to do?" "First thing, I'm going to hire you. I need a liaison with the Martian military. That should be you. Can you handle it?" No one at the bar was talking to anybody now. The room might have been empty. The only sounds were the soft music and Draper's laughter. An older man wearing clove and cinnamon cologne walked by, drawn by the quiet spectacle without knowing what it was. "I'm a Martian Marine," Draper said. "Martian. You're UN. Earth. We aren't even citizens of the same planet. You can't hire me." "My name's Kristjen Avasarala. Ask around." They were silent for a moment. "I'm Bobby," Draper said. "Nice to meet you, Bobby. Come work for me." "Can I think about it?" "Of course," Avasarala said, and had her terminal send Bobby her private number. "So long as when you're done thinking, you come work for me." At the VIP apartments, Avasarala tuned the system to the kind of music Arjun might be listening to just then, if he wasn't already asleep. She fought back the urge to call him. It was late already, and she was just drunk enough to get maudlin. Sobbing into her hand terminal about how much she loved her husband wasn't something she longed to make a habit of. She pulled off her sari and took a long, hot shower. She didn't drink alcohol often. Usually she didn't like how it dulled her mind. That night, it seemed to loosen her up, gave her brain the little extra jazz it needed to see connections. Draper kept her connected to Mars, even if not to the day-by-day slog of the negotiations. That was a good start. There would be other connections, too. Foster and Data Services could be brought in. She'd need to start routing more work through him, build a relationship. It wouldn't do to march in and insist on being his new best friend just because he happened to be managing the encryption requests for Nguyen. A few no-strings-attached cupcakes first, then the hook. Who else could she? Her hand terminal chimed a priority alert. She turned off the water and grabbed a bathrobe, wrapping herself tightly and double-knotting the stay before she accepted the connection. She was years past flashing someone over a hand terminal, no matter how much she'd drunk. The connection came from someone in priority surveillance. The image that flashed up was a middle-aged man with ill-advised mutton-chop whiskers. "Amir, you mad dog! What have you done that they make you work so late?" "Move to Atlanta, miss," the analyst said with a toothy grin. He was the only one who ever called her miss. She hadn't spoken to him in 3 years. "I've just come back from lunch. I had an unscheduled report flagged for you. Contact immediately. I tried your assistant, but he didn't answer." "He's young. He still sleeps sometimes. It's a weakness. Stand by while I set privacy." The moment of friendly banter was over. Avasarala leaned forward, tapping her hand terminal twice to add a layer of encryption. The red icon went green. "Go ahead," she said. "It's from Ganymede, miss. You have a standing order on James Holden." "Yes?" "He's on the move. He made an apparent rendezvous with a local scientist, Praxidiki Mung." "What's Mung?" In Atlanta, Amir transitioned smoothly to a different file. "Botanist, miss. Emigrated to Ganymede with his family when he was a child. Schooled there. Specializes in partial pressure, low-light soybean strains. Divorced, one child. No known connections to the OPA or any established political party." "Go ahead." "Holden, Mang, and Burton have left their ship. They're armed and they've made contact with a small group of private security types. Pinkwater."
"How many?"
"The on-site analyst doesn't say, miss. A small force. Should I query?"
"What lag are we at?"
Amir's brown-black eyes flickered.
41 minutes, 8 seconds, miss."
"Hold the query. If I have anything else, I can send them together." "The on-site analyst reports that Holden negotiated with the private security. Either a last-minute renegotiation or else the whole meeting was extemporaneous. It appears they reached some agreement.
The full group proceeded to an unused corridor complex and forced entry.
A what?
A disused access door, miss.
What the fuck is that supposed to mean? How big is it? Where is it?
Should I query?
You should go to Ganymede and kick this sorry excuse for an on-site analyst in the balls. Add a clarification request.
Yes, miss, Amir said with the ghost of a smile. Then suddenly he frowned. An update. One moment. So, the OPA had something on Ganymede. Maybe something they'd put there. Maybe something they'd found. Either way, this mysterious door made things a degree more interesting. While Amir read through and digested the new update, Avasarala scratched the back of her hand and reevaluated her position. She'd thought Holden was there as an observer. Forward intelligence. That might be wrong. If he'd gone to meet with this Praxidiki Mung, this utterly under-the-radar botanist, the OPA might already know quite a bit about Bobby Draper's monster. Add the fact that Holden's boss had the only known sample of the protomolecule, and a narrative about the Ganymede collapse began to take shape. There were holes in it, though. If the OPA had been playing with the protomolecule, there had been no sign of it. And Fred Johnson's psychological profile didn't match with terrorist attacks. Johnson was old school, and the monster attack was decidedly new. There's been a firefight, miss. Holden and his people have met armed resistance. They've set a perimeter. The on-site analysts can't approach.
Resistance? I thought this was supposed to be unused. Who the fuck are they shooting at?
Shall I query?
God damn it!
40 light minutes away, something important was going on, and she was here, in a bedroom that wasn't hers, trying to make sense of it by pressing her ear to the wall. The frustration was a physical sensation. It felt like being crushed. 40 minutes out, 40 minutes back. Whatever she said, whatever order she gave, it would get there almost an hour and a half behind what was clearly a rapidly changing situation.
Pull him in, she said. Holden, Burton, their Pinkwater friends, and this mysterious botanist. Bring them all in, now.
Amir in Atlanta paused.
If they're in a firefight, miss, then send in the dogs, break up the fight, and take them in. We're past surveillance. Get it done.
Yes, miss.
Contact me as soon as it's done.
Yes, miss. She watched Amir's face as he framed the order, confirmed it, sent it out. She could practically imagine the screen, the strokes of his fingers. She willed him to go faster, to press her intent out past the speed of light, and get the damn thing done.
Order's out. As soon as I hear from the on-site analyst, I'll reach you.
I'll be here. If I don't take the connection, try again until I wake up. She dropped the link and sat back. Her brain felt like a swarm of bees. James Holden had changed the game again. The boy had a talent for that, but that in itself made him a known quantity. This other one, this Mung, had come from her blind side. The man might be a mole, or a volunteer, or a stalking goat sent to lead the OPA into a trap. She considered turning off the light, trying to sleep, then abandoned it as a bad bet. Instead, she set up a connection with the UN's Intelligence Research Database. It was an hour and a half at earliest before she'd hear anything more. In the meantime, she wanted to know who Praxidiki Mung was and why he mattered. Chapter 19. Holden.
Naomi, prep the ship. We have to get off this moon. We have to do it right now.
All around Holden, the black filament spread, a dark spider's web with him at the center. He was on Eros again. He was seeing thousands of bodies turning into something else. He thought he'd made it off, but Eros just kept coming. He and Miller had gotten out, but it got Miller anyway.
Now it was back for him.
"What's the matter, Jim?" Naomi said from the distance of the suit radio. "Jim?
Prep the ship."
"It's the stuff," Amos said. He was talking to Naomi. "Like from Eros."
"Jesus, they..."
Holden managed to gasp out before the fear welled up in his mind, robbing him of speech. His heart banged against his ribs like it wanted out, and he had to check the oxygen levels on his HUD. It felt like there wasn't enough air in the room. Out of the corner of his eye, something appeared to scuttle up the wall like a disembodied hand, leaving a trail of brown slime in its wake. When Holden spun and pointed his assault rifle at it, it resolved into a bloodstain below a discolored patch of ice. Amos moved toward him, a worried look on his broad face. Holden waved him off, then set the butt of his rifle on the ground and leaned on a nearby crate to catch his breath.
"We should probably move out," Wendell said.
He and Paula were helping hold up the man who'd been gutshot. The injured man was having trouble breathing. A small red bubble of blood had formed in his left nostril, and it inflated and deflated with each ragged gasp the man took.
"Jim?" Naomi said in his ear, her voice soft. "Jim, I saw it through Amos's suit cam, and I know what it means. I'm getting the ship ready. That encrypted local traffic? It's dropped way off. I think everyone's gone."
"Everyone's gone," Holden echoed. The diminished remains of his Pinkwater team were staring at him, the concern on their faces shifting to fear, his own terror infecting them even though they had no idea what the filament meant. They wanted him to do something, and he knew he had to, but he couldn't think what it was. The black web filled his head with flashing images, running too quickly to make sense, like video played at high speed. Julie Mao in her shower, the black threads surrounding her, her body twisted into a nightmare. Bodies scattered across the floor of a radiation chamber, the zombie-like infected staggering off the trams in Eros, vomiting brown bile on everyone around them. Even a drop of the goo, a death sentence. Video captures of the horror show Eros had become. A torso stripped to a ribcage and one arm dragging itself through the protomolecule landscape on some unknowable mission.
"Cap," Amos said, then moved over to touch Holden's arm.
Holden yanked away, almost falling over in the process. He swallowed the thick, lemony-flavored saliva building up in his throat and said,
"Okay, I'm here. Let's go. Naomi, call Alex. We need the Rossi."
Naomi didn't answer for a moment, then said,
"What about the block?"
"Right fucking now, Naomi," Holden yelled. "Right fucking now, call Alex right now."
She didn't reply, but the gutshot man took one final ragged breath and then collapsed, nearly dragging the wounded Wendell to the floor with him.
"We have to go," Holden said to Wendell, meaning, "We can't help him. If we stay, we all die."
Wendell nodded but went to one knee and began taking the man's light armor off, not understanding. Amos pulled the emergency med kit off his harness and dropped down next to Wendell to begin working on the wounded man while Paula watched, her face pale.
"Have to go," Holden said again, wanting to grab Amos and shake him until he understood. "Amos, stop. We have to go right now. Eros..."